What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of The AllSmith Project. Today's guest is creating a healthier tomorrow today. He's a former college basketball player and the author of The Vitality System, the ultimate guide to living an active, healthy, and happy life. Today, I'm excited to connect with Kyle Gonzalez. What's up, man?
What's going on? How we doing, man? I appreciate you having me on, and definitely fired up and looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, man. I almost wish we would have pressed record during the preliminary conversation offline, because both of us were just firing on all cylinders. That was a blast.
Yeah, no. It's always good. I think our stories are so similar that it just kind of comes flowing out. But yeah, no, man, I'm excited to dive into whatever direction we want to dive into.
Totally, man. I was fortunate to connect with an NBA point guard a few weeks ago, and it's in the title of his episode, Mr. Larry Drew, but something that came to mind as I briefly mentioned firing on all cylinders is the ball finds energy. And I think it's ironic that you and I got to cross paths at the CrossFit Games last year. You were working with the incredible Momentous, which we can absolutely dive into a little bit later. But I think there's a reason we cross paths. I think everything you're doing with the Vitality System is awesome. But basketball players, man, game recognized game. We end up finding each other and realizing that our stories are so similar. And I just very much love and appreciate the sport of basketball for that reason.
Yeah, no, man, it brings people together. It's a vibrant community, but yeah, man, I think no matter what, you know, we do, like you said, good energy finds itself and finds each other. And I think, I've been fortunate to be around some great people. And so, you know, likewise with you, it's good to be, you know, around great people, to learn from great people. And that's what I'm, you know, that's what life's about.
Totally, man. Do you happen to tune into some of All-Star Weekend this past weekend? Did you watch the dunk contest and the three-point shooting contest?
I did watch a little bit of it. My time zone was a little off, so I was, you know, trying to tune in when I could. But yeah, it's different. It's different nowadays. The competitive edge is kind of taken out of it a little bit, but it's still, you know, some parts are entertaining to watch for sure.
For sure. How do you feel about that? You know, a part of me sides with the players and gets it because, you know, you obviously don't want to injure yourself. There's different financial incentives that I think the league is starting to put in a little bit to try to make it a little bit more competitive. There's that intangible that's in the soul of like, dang, you just dogged me on that crossover. Like, I'm going to get you back. And it's this like push-pull back and forth that we saw a little bit back in the day, especially when Kobe was playing in all-star games where he wanted to go head-to-head. Every now and then we see it in the final, like 5 minutes of the end of the fourth. Yep. But what are your thoughts on that? Like, it is tough to make it competitive when we got, you know, an 82 game season plus potential playoffs. Yep. They're trying to stay happy, healthy, and injury free. But then the other side of it is like, we want to see entertainment as fans and we want to see a very competitive game.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit torn as well, but I think everybody has that competitive edge in them and wants to take it out. I think now with the social media culture, you know, people are scared to kind of, you know, let fully loose because they might get embarrassed or this or that might happen. But I ultimately think deep inside each of these players, the reason they're all stars, the reason they're at the level they are is because they have that competitive fire in them. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's in there. I just think the NBA needs to somehow incentivize that and get them to bring that out, because ultimately, it's you never really get to see the best players go at each other, you know, all of the best players at once. And now the international game is getting, you know, to a way higher level, so it's awesome to see that, and I'm excited for the Olympics this summer. But yeah, it needs to be incentivized better, and I think something needs to happen within the players, because obviously you can only do so much from the outside. The players have to get together and be like, hey, look, like, you know, we want to give a better product to the fans. We want to show what, you know, we're made of, and we want to put all the best on display. So I think it's twofold. You know, the NBA needs to better incentivize it, but also the players need to kind of come together and say, hey, look, like, you know, this is what it's all about. This is why we're doing what we're doing. You could get injured on any night doing anything, but I think what we have now is like, I don't know. It's barely even a game. It's just them shooting shot. It's not, I don't know.
No, I definitely agree with you. Kobe talked about it at one point. I think we saw it kind of circulating social media. And I was fortunately to be a part of it on a few different occasions. But the pickup runs at UCLA in the summer are badass, man. I used to run the Santa Monica Stairs over on 7th and San Vicente there in Santa Monica. And we would travel back over to UCLA. And man, some of the runs in there were so good. I just remember seeing Russell Westbrook, Carmelo, Paul George, different guys kind of cruising through there. And I mean, you're not only just incredibly competitive defensively too, like guys are trying to get stops. Yeah. And after they get the stop, they're letting you know they got the stop. And it's physical. Yeah. There's a lot of hand checking. You're calling your own fouls. There's arguing after every single play. But when you walk in there, there's a vibration from the walls. I mean, if those walls could talk, man, and share some of those stories, it's pretty impressive. But you also made a great point, and that is in social media culture, people are unwilling to look like fools or end up on some sort of crossover or dunk piece. And I really do believe that in the pursuit of success, you do need to be willing to look like a fool on occasion. And I think if you're willing to do that, whether that's starting a podcast, writing a book, being an athlete, public speaking for the first time, there needs to be that element of I suck. Rejection doesn't feel good. And then in your journey towards peak expression or gradual improvement, that feeling, you start to get callous to it. And then you start to get better and better. And it's less about trying to satisfy external perception and get validation from others, and more so like, man, I'm doing this because it's what I love. It's what I'm passionate about. It's what lights my heart on fire. I heard a story about art, and it was like, hey, if you're painting something and you're trying to create that for somebody else, it feels pushy and salesy. But if you're like, man, I'm just into this, I'm creating this for me. And if I love it, there's somebody else that thinks just like me, they're going to love it too. And I don't know, in you saying some of those things, it just unlocked a lot of different creative thoughts.
Yeah. And speaking of creative thoughts, Rick Rubin has a new book, The Creative Act, great new book. And one of the concepts he has is the audience comes last in the creative process.
I love that.
And I love that because, it's ultimately about you putting out the best thing you can put out. And so for me, it's just fail fast, fail forward, fail often. And I'm actually looking for failure because that tells me that there's growth behind that. And so for me, it's always been something that has hard. It's hard to kind of get over that hump and initially be vulnerable to continue to fail because that's not easy. But you gotta become friends with failure because it's going to happen a lot on the path to growth. And so nowadays it's just like I press, you know, record, I press publish, I press, you know, all of that often, because again, what's the point of it hiding behind the wall? Or what's the point of, you know, all of that? Like, it's the information always, you want the information to win. And so it's not going to get out there if you hide it behind, you know, your notes page or whatever. It's, you know, release the ideas, iterate, continue to get better, continue to fail, continue to put yourself out there. But yeah, the audience comes last. That's one of my favorite concepts I pulled from that book.
That's great, man. I really want to marinate on that. Maybe I'll make that the title of your episode.
Hey, we'll see.
Something that comes to mind there is the pain of regret is way better than the pain of failure or suffering. Or vice versa. The pain of regret is way worse than the pain of suffering or failure. And I think that's something that a lot of us should sit with for a moment. Because in the moment, there's a feeling. It's like, ooh, this doesn't feel good. It's like touching a hot stove. But the feeling goes away. Regret stays, and it lingers. And when you look at a graveyard, it's the richest place in the world. It's songs that weren't sang. It's books that weren't written, conversations that weren't had, moments that weren't really capitalized on. And that's what I think is really magical around just that little ping pong piece that we just shared. The audience comes last. Do it for you, guys. Do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like this concept of just like you know, you're the only person that can be you. So why would you try to be someone else? Why would you try to show something different? Because that's, you know, that's what makes you unique, is that nobody has the same DNA, has lived in the same environment you've lived in, has gone through the same things that you've gone through. Use that. That's fuel. That should be something that you highlight, and your perspective is completely unique because nobody else has lived the life that you've lived. And so when I've kind of shifted my perspective to that, it's, you know, it's not about really me. It's about, like I said, putting out the best product, putting out the best book, putting out the best podcast, putting out whatever it is, and let the audience take whatever they want from it and continue to build, continue to grow, continue to put things out. And yeah, of course, you got to experiment, you got to iterate, you have to improve, but improvement comes from failure. Improvement comes from, you know, really pushing the boundaries of what's possible, really getting close to the edge, exploring those edges, getting comfortable with the edges. I always say you got to get comfortable, you know, outside of your comfort zone. And so, yeah, I think ultimately that's where the best, you know, like you said, songs, books, ideas lie, is right outside your comfort zone, right in the areas that's that are unknown and unexplored.
Mm-hmm. Something that I was thinking about as you were saying that is it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. And that's it sounds cliche. It sounds kind of cheesy, but it's like, it takes 10 years of like trying and experimenting and being in the lab and putting out the product, the content, getting rejected, door-to-door sales, email marketing, trying your best to just keep on going. But you need the reps.
Yeah.
And you're never really an overnight success. It just, you had to do all those things to arrive at that moment, or the moment probably just wouldn't be there in general. And that's something that I see with you very much so, especially in the development of your book, The Vitality System, which I want to get to that a little bit later in our conversation. But what I'm really curious about, Kyle, is what was your childhood like that helped foster some of your brain chemistry and your perseverance in chasing edges?
Yeah. Yeah. So I always start with, you know, when I was super young, my dad was a huge explorer. My dad was always getting us out of the house, always interested in taking a trip into a park or a museum or whatever the case was, always asking questions. And he exposed us to that when we were super, super young. And so I was always curious about things that, you know, the ocean, curious about sports, curious about, you know, all these different things. And so early in my life, I was just very much exposed to a vast world and always curious about how it works, how the body works, all these different things. And so fast forward a little bit later, and my father was diagnosed with cancer and he passed away when I was 8 years old. So I was kind of exposed to the health and wellness world very early in my life and how your health can be taken away from you. And I was very young. So processing that at that age is, you know, you don't know how to, you know, react to things like that. But ultimately, you know, my mom, single mom, three kids, raised us all. And my mom was the type of person who she would give you the shirt off her back if it was the last piece of clothing she had. And she would do anything for her kids, for her family, for the people she held close. She worked in the health and wellness industry for 20 plus years. And so what I saw from my mom was a perseverance. She never showed what she was going through. She always provided for us. And it was kind of this just kind of sacrifice of everything she had to help others. And so, again, I took pieces from both my parents and I learned about adversity young. I learned about, like, you know, kind of providing for myself young. And all of that kind of led to, again, this curiosity from one end, and then helping others from my mom on this other end, and to, hey, I want to be in a place where I can help others live better lives. And, you know, quickly I turned that into health and wellness, learning everything I could about the human body from a young age in high school. And so again, I wasn't a big reader. I was just a big kind of experimenter. And so I tried just about everything you could try, you know, whether it was sports, whether it was training methods, whether it was, you know, early, you know, back in the day doing meditation and breath work and all that before it was the cool thing to do. And so it kind of translated through sports, where I really, really, really wanted to understand how I could get the most out of myself and push my body to be the best. I was never the strongest. I was never the fastest. I was never the best at any sport that I played, but I was willing to work harder than anyone, but also smarter than anyone. And so I think that all culminated in, you know, me just having this deep, deep seated passion for health and wellness, for how the human body worked. And you know, that kind of just kept stepping up and up and up as I got further in my career.
I love to hear it, man. It very much relates to what we talked about briefly online, offline, which is just the funnel of the anvil behind me and how we started broad. Yeah. Your father ended up passing away from cancer, and that really ignited you were trying to learn how doctors operate, the healthcare system. How do we optimize? How do we biohack things? How do we work a little bit smarter? And then it sounds like that bridged the gap to you yourself and thinking, okay, I'm not the biggest, the fastest, or the strongest, but I've got this intrinsic walk-on mentality, and I'm going to try to maximize my potential, squeeze as much juice out of my orange. And then once I get to the end of that road, I'm going to take all that data, knowledge, and practical experience and then funnel it to the world in different forms and fashions. And that's in the form of your book, your podcast, and your newsletter.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
That's dope,
right,
man.
On. And yeah. And I think you said it best. It's never really about me. It's ultimately about letting the information win and giving people, empowering people to find their own path, find their own way. And I think in this day and age, we see a lot of people who are trying to cram their diet, cram their recovery method, cram their exercise program down people's throats and trying to mold people to their program. When ultimately, I think what we're looking for is consistency. What we're looking for is adherence. And in order to get that, people have to kind of come about these things in their own way, in a way that works for them. And so what I've always tried to do is figure out, all right, there's A, B, C, D, E, F, D ways to, you know, go about this thing. How do I present a framework or a principle where people can find, oh, A option works for me, or, oh, C option works for me, instead of saying everybody has to go to A. And so the vitality system and, you know, all the stuff that I create is in order to help people, empower people to take control of their own health and wellness. So they don't have to rely on a, you know, product or service or wearable or, you know, whatever the case is, they can understand, they can kind of deduce and make the decision on their own. They can make their choices and come to the right conclusions that are best for them.
The health and wellness space, man, is vast. It's wide, it's deep, it's convoluted, it's conflicting information. There's the challenges of healthcare and what's approved and funneled and manipulated by the FDA and the CDC. And then there's, you know, the health and wellness experts that are trying to sell their product. And they're also convoluted and messy and foggy in some ways. And then there's the other space that's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to simplify this into the most digestible form of information. And typically, at least from what I've seen, that comes in the form of lists. That comes in the form of bullet pointed things with short, actionable explanations where people can take that information and immediately use it within their day-to-day life. And something that I pulled from your podcast, which I very much appreciated that I'd love to explore with you today, are your seven keys to unlocking consistency, with that first one being about willpower and self-control.
Yeah, man, it's consistency is the crux that everything lies on. It is what I've kind of based a lot of my practices on. I usually don't ask what's going to work the best. I ask what can I be the most consistent with? And I think there's a huge difference between those two things. And a lot of times people initially, when they go out for a diet, when they go out for an exercise program, they want to shoot for 100. They want to go for the thing that's going to help them the most, the quickest, whatever. And I think taking a step back and understanding what's the ultimate goal is consistency. And one of the questions I've asked all the people that I worked with is, what can you do with 100% confidence day in and day out? And so that kind of helps people take a step back and be like, I'm not going to be able to work out for an hour every day. That's just not gonna, that's not feasible. So maybe it's, I'm going to work out for 15 minutes, five times a week or whatever it is. Start from there and building up. And I think a lot of these habit books and, you know, you see Atomic Habits, the Power of Habit, both great books. A lot of them, you know, it's start small, start easy, start simple, and build your way up. And I think there's something about using your willpower less and less and less and creating the right environment for success. So I've always believed that environment's going to trump will most times. And so the more you can save that will for the rainy day when it's cold and you have to go out for that run, the more you're going to be able to call on that when you need it. But instead, if you're using it every single day to get over the hump, you miss your morning workout, so you have to do it in the evening after a long day of work, or, you know, you didn't do what you wanted to do, you know, in the time frame that you did it. So again, the less you call on that willpower, the more you can save it for the times you need it. And really, it's about constructing an environment that's conducive to success. So, you know, people always say like, out of sight, out of mind. Well, I always say like, in view, easy to pursue. Like, keep things, you know, in view, keep things, you know, within your environment. And it could be cleaning out the kitchen of junk food. It could be whatever. And that's out of sight, out of mind. But the opposite is, you know, keep an apple out or keep, you know, whatever supplements you need to take out. And so, again, I think it's more about constructing your environment and less about trying to really use willpower. Cause I mean, willpower, man, it fatigues quick, as we all know.
For sure, man. A couple of things that come to mind that you're talking about is it is more important to have a low hanging fruit because it's more sustainable to reach for that rather than getting a ladder and a rope to get all the way up for the high hanging fruit. And I know there's people on either end of the spectrum. Some people like to say, do the hardest thing first, and then everything else is easier, and you kind of chip away. Yep. But I really like getting like that dopamine hit of just like checking the box, like early on with easy things. Like, hey, I made the bed. I let the dog out. I jumped in the cold plunge. Yep. I made some coffee. I got morning sunlight.
Yep.
I did my breath work. I had my 5-minute gratitude practice. Those things are things that are relatively quick. You can complete all of those tasks in probably under 45 to 60 minutes. And then all of a sudden you've got momentum. You've got some generalized wins that then allow you to attack the rest. We talked about willpower and self-control being your first key to unlocking consistency. Your second one, you mentioned being a product of the right environment. Your third one is all about progress over perfection. Will you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think this is one that I've dealt with a lot in my career, and a lot of the clients that I've worked with have dealt with a lot. And it's similar to an idea I mentioned earlier of, you know, trying to shoot for that perfect solution right at the beginning. And with that, you undermine the process it took to get there and what it takes each step of the way. And so for me, it's all about, you know, you hear the cliche 1% better every day, but there's a lot of truth to that, in that taking any type of step forward is forward. And that's what you want to focus on, is forward each and every day, because some days it's going to be 1%. Some days it's going to be 5%. Some days it's going to be 0.001%. But as long as it's forward, like you said, that momentum concept is huge. And if you can learn to celebrate small wins, which is another one of the keys, the right way. A lot of times, you know, people will go out for a run and come back and chug a Gatorade, and it's like the same amount of calories that run just burned, or even more. But anyway, I think with this progress over perfection, it's how can you build that momentum? How can you actually get into the process to a point where you start to enjoy the process? Because I always say, like, life is a process. Like, you're never going to be out of the process. You're always going to be building, improving, learning. And so the more you can accept that, sit with that, and understand that, hey, this is what it's going to take to continue to get better. So how do I find ways to enjoy it? How do I find ways to get better at it? How do I find ways to make it easier? That's really what it's all about, because life is a process, and, you know, news alert, everything is going to be, you know, adversity. Everything is going to be, you know, coming at you. So, I think life's a process. So there's no point in avoiding it.
That's my favorite pillar that you have in relation to consistency. Yeah. And part of the reason for that is, I'll be happy when mentality is really dangerous. Because yes. I think as human beings, we're very much addicted to progress. We want to see the raise in monetary value every year. We want to be stronger each year. It's this periodized model of like, we need to keep improving. And whether that's been a societal norm or not, Jordan Peterson talks about it a little bit in relation to stagnation is hell's waiting room. The moment we as human beings feel like we're not moving the needle in the right direction, or we're going backwards, or we're staying in the same spot, now, even if our life is very good, our mind will start to go a little bit haywire. We'll start to create internal problems. Maybe we'll manifest in pain, but there's not a fulfilling component to just existing in this world. You want to be building something. You want to be practicing the 9 ancestral tenets and really be bonding and connecting with people into pursuit of those edges and seeing what are we capable of? What's on the other side of that wall? I want to be curious. I want to keep going. And the moment you just stay in one spot, I think it's a very dangerous concept, or even just the process of, oh, I'll be happy when I make that much money, or I'll be happy when I sell the book. It's like, no, you won't. You'll be thinking about the next thing. And so I really like that one around progress over perfection. The fourth key to unlocking consistency is spotting roadblocks and be willing to go over, under, or around. Will you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Move fast and break shit. LSKD develops functional sportswear with a streetwear aesthetic that's on a mission to inspire you to chase the vibe through sport, fitness, and adventure. I train daily in the rep shorts and love the versatility they offer. The zipper pocket is an absolute game changer. I go from training at the gym directly to meetings, running errands, or prepping for podcasts. The LSKD tribe has become true family, and we are excited to continue to develop our community. Shop now at lskd.com and use code ALLSMITH. We chase the vibe here at ALLSMITH. Let's all become 1% better every day.
Yeah, this is a big one as well, because roadblocks are inevitable. Obstacles are inevitable. They're going to happen. Like, you're not going to avoid that. And whether it's a small or a big roadblock, the more you can prepare before the roadblock, the easier it will be to go past, through, or around it. And so I think we all know what our weaknesses are, what our roadblocks are. Most people are way more in tune with those things than they are with their strengths. And so I think it's ultimately reflecting with yourself, being honest with yourself, and looking in the mirror and saying, I'm not a morning person. I'm not going to work out at 7 a.m. every day. So don't even put that in your purview, because it's like, all right, let's level with myself and say, you know, maybe I'll do 9 a.m. because I know I don't usually wake up at 7 a.m. That's not going to work for me. And I think the more we can kind of spot those things, or another, you know, common one that you hear is, oh, I'm going to put my clothes out before, the night before, because I know that's kind of a barrier to entry, is getting up and getting the clothes and the whole process of getting a workout in. But I think we know our weaknesses. It's just about looking in the mirror and understanding, hey, how can I address these things, accept them, and then understand the more I accept them, the more I can actually create a plan for moving around them. And so whatever that might be, it's first a real thing of acceptance. And I think that can be hard for some people, because some people want to believe in their head. It's like, oh, I can do that. Yeah, that seems easy. And of course, they're making that decision when they're sitting, they haven't done anything yet. It's easy to come up with that grand master plan of, I'm going to work out 7 days a week. I'm going to only eat this. I'm going to sleep this much. But I think you have to constantly reassess. You have to constantly experiment. And, you know, one of those things is just figuring out what could possibly stop you, what could possibly get in your way on that journey, and making a plan for kind of going around that, pre-facing it. So it's easier to do. And it's like, oh, all right, I knew this roadblock was going to be here. So now this is what I'm going to do, A, B, or C.
A couple other ways to say that are being willing to execute long after the feeling has subsided when you said you were going to do the thing. And it just goes to show, feelings come and go. You may have planned the night before to be up at 7, and you had the liquid courage. You had a couple of drinks with buddies, and you had this big, hairy, audacious goal to do the 7 a.m. workout every day this week. You're going to do 75 hard. And then all of a sudden, the alarm clock goes off at 5:30 or 6. And then there's that other voice that's like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I've gotten this far. My life's pretty good. Yep. I'm warm and comfortable right here, right now. Sleep's probably more important than getting up.
Yeah.
But I think what it really aligns with, and you do a great job of epitomizing this, but also describing it in your work, is confidence is proof and evidence that you are who you say you are. And I think when you say things and then you consistently over time don't execute on what you say, you lose self-respect. You stop respecting yourself. And then all of a sudden, your words carry less meaning. And if they carry less meaning to you, how do you think that diffuses into the rest of the world?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I heard it on a Jay Shetty podcast, but he had a great line that was something along the lines of, self-respect is more important than self-care. Mm. And I think a lot of people love self-care. It's like, oh, self-care, you know, I'm going to get extra sleep. And it's easy to kind of fall back into that self-care because you want to convince yourself that it's a positive, when most times and sometimes it can be. But self-respect, now that is where you are who you say you are. You do what you say you're going to do, you know, what you say you'll do, and you constantly show up for yourself. And I think, you know, to constantly, you know, quote a lot of greats, but James Clear in Atomic Habits, he has a concept of casting votes for the person you want to become. And so when you show up for that workout, when you eat that salad over having the, you know, fried meal that you're going to have, when you get that 8 hours of sleep, you're casting votes for the person you want to become. And that sticks in your mind of like, hey, remember that day when I turned down the fast food for the salad? Maybe I can do that again. And you get confidence and it builds and it's momentum. And so I think if you can continue to cast those votes, your brain will start to actually believe that you are that person, because you're becoming that.
You're developing like a personal audience that's like clapping for you when you make the good choice. Versus in the beginning, it's like one person, which is you, clapping for you. And then I imagine it as like all the little tiny cells and the little gut microbiome and the brain cells and all these little friends that, like, when you when you cast those votes consistently over time, you're gaining like a tribe of followers that's like, you did the thing. Like, good job. You did the thing. Cool. Now we're gonna do the thing with you. Versus if you do the thing once, you get that one clap. And then if you never do the thing again, it's almost like the body keeps the score. And it's like, what are you doing, man? I feel horrible now because you made the poor choice instead of the good choice.
Yep. And a lot of the times it is just you and that internal crowd. And so if that internal crowd isn't giving you any love or any feedback or anything, it can be lonely.
Oh yeah.
But when you do the thing, it's like your internal crowd's going crazy. Adrenaline's pumping, dopamine's going, and it's a good feeling. It's a great feeling. Like, I tell people, how many workouts have you done where afterwards you regret it? Like, not many ever, really, for me. And it's like every time I do a workout, every time I get the right amount of sleep, I am just like, oh my God, like, I feel like a new human. I feel like a better human. And the other concept I was thinking about earlier that I mentioned in my book and probably in my podcast somewhere as well is motivation flows when action shows. And so people get that backwards. Mm-hmm. People think it's supposed to be motivation to action. And no, that it's honestly, what gets the motivation to flow is when you show yourself you can do the thing consistently. And then it rushes in like a tidal wave, because then you're not only proving it to yourself, but you've already overcome it. So it's like, oh, I can do this again. I can wake up at 7 again. I already did it. And so I think that concept is something that it took me a while to understand. You have the people that have to watch the David Goggins video, or they
stay hard.
They have to have the perfect, you know, scenario to do a workout, or the perfect thing set up. And it's like, no, do the smallest action and let that momentum build. So yeah, motivation flows and action shows.
That's a good one, man. The next key to unlocking consistency is controlling what you can control. And that's more specific to your effort.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, you know, in life, we don't control a lot of things. And there are so many things that are out of our control that we think we control. And so when it comes time to realize that, hey, we actually didn't control that thing, we're down in the dumps, we feel like we failed, and, you know, all that negative energy flows in. But when we focus on the things that we can control, our mindset, our effort, our attitude, you know, all of those things are within our control. And if we can kind of manufacture those things to be in our favor, we can get over a lot of the uncontrollables that we'll face anyway, with the mindset of, hey, I'm going to move past this anyway. I'm going to have a growth mindset. I'm going to stay positive. I'm going to continue to bring energy towards this. And that can be, you know, the original time that you wanted to work out, you know, something happens, your kids, you have to take care of your kids. So you miss that time. It's okay. There's 24 hours in a day. I'll have a block here, here, and here. Which one's going to be ideal? How can I adjust the workout? And instead of it being, oh my God, I missed the only time I was going to work out. Now I can't work out today. It's over. Da, 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 da. So I think in life, understanding, it's like that's what Stoicism is based on, is, you know, a lot of life is out of your control. So understanding what you control and making sure that you're bringing the right mindset to that is, you know, paramount to any journey where you're encountering or doing something that you've never done before. Because I think that's where the most uncertainty is going to come in. That's where the most doubt is going to come in. And, you know, I think in this life, it's all about the energy that you can bring to things. And that's not just physical energy. And I think Huberman talks about it a lot. It's mental energy. And I think a lot of the times when I go for a walk, I get mental energy, and that allows me to write better. That allows me to show up better to my wife. That allows me to, you know, provide for other people. And I think people just need to understand that, you know, a lot of what's going on around us is only distraction, and we need to find what we need to do to show up best for our life, for our health, for whatever the case might be.
Yeah, that was very well said. What I'm hearing is the rigidity to hold the standard, but the flexibility to adapt when needed. And I think it's great to have systems and parameters and a blueprint to have structure. And with that being the goal, it allows us to then execute. But then reading between the lines when needed, when there is a kid that's sick, or we have an extra work call or some sort of emergency or flat tire. I like the way you said that a lot. The next one is celebrate success the right way.
Oh, yeah. This is one where in the coaching world, I've probably had to deal with the most. And obviously, I'll use personal training as an example, or strength conditioning, whatever you want to use. You only get to work with these people for maybe 3-4 hours out of the week when you're in that weight room with them, or when you're in that session with them. And a lot of the times when they kind of go out and leave that, it's like, I did my session, I did my work, now I can kind of let loose for the rest. And it's like, that's a fraction, a tiny, tiny fraction in the whole kind of your health, that session that you did. And so with celebrating wins the right way, it's that concept that I mentioned earlier of, you want to celebrate in a way that's going to be conducive to your success. And so if you are constantly going on a run, but rewarding yourself with a donut after, it's like, which you're casting one vote with the run, and then you're casting a wrong vote with the donut. So it cancels each other out. So it's like, how can you continue to cast votes for yourself? And maybe it's, oh, okay, if I read X amount throughout the week, then I get to buy another book. And it's like, oh, great. Like, you know, you're actually doing something, celebrating that win by buying another book, but you're also fueling your progress with learning and getting better and growing. And so it could be, you know, whatever the case is, it could be, oh, if I get this workout in, then I get to buy this new, you know, workout equipment or workout outfit that I wanted to get. If I get to 7 workouts, then I get to buy this cool new shoes or whatever. And it doesn't have to be buying something. It doesn't have to be, you know, anything that's monetary of value. But I think as long as you're keeping that momentum flowing forward instead of casting votes opposite ways, I think that's what it really comes down to. And I've seen a lot of people who come to me and they're like, Kyle, I've been consistent with my workouts. I've been showing up for our sessions. It's been 4 to 6 weeks. Yet when they go after their session, they're going to, you know, eat something that they shouldn't be eating or whatever. And it's like, how can you look at the whole of your health and understand that it's going to be sacrifices in each area, whether it's nutrition, whether it's recovery, whether it's lifestyle, whatever the case is. How do you continue to build on your progress instead of taking two steps forward and three steps back? How do you take one step, one step, one step, or one step, two steps, three steps? Whatever the case is, I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I agree. I think the celebratory component needs to be taken with a grain of salt and needs to be done within context and reason. So if you're going to buy the outfit, that's cool. As coaches and leaders in the health and wellness space, we always want to see people celebrating the way they look and feel, and look good, play good, feel good, right? Like Deion Sanders, baby. But then on the other side of that coin is like, if it doesn't fit within your financial fitness, and now you're putting yourself in debt to pursue that outfit, you're getting that quick dopamine hit of retail therapy, then it's like, okay, well, we want the transferable skills of what you're doing within your sessions to translate into decreased levels of stress and cortisol. So maybe we don't buy the new outfit. Maybe we push that into a later date when we have the financial fitness so it fits within our means. Or maybe we ask for a gift card for an upcoming birthday or a holiday coming up. Could be another solution-based orientation there. And then the other thing I like to talk about, when you're going to have like a celebratory drink or a cheat meal or something of that sort, rather than just making it about you and being like, hey, I'm going to go have the thing because, you know, I lost 20 pounds training with Kyle. What if it's, hey, I'm actually going to go with Kyle and we're going to have dinner together to celebrate this amazing journey that we've been on. Maybe we bring our significant others and we build a memory out of it, as opposed to this like closet style eating of like, I did the thing and now I'm just going to overindulge. And like you said, take three steps back in comparison to the one or two steps forward. I like that one a lot. This next one, I think aligns with both of us from the basketball world. And that is having short-term memory for the setbacks. If you're going to miss 10 shots in a row, you got to truly believe that the 11th is going in.
I want to take a step back to the last one. I think another concept that just came to me was you want to celebrate the effort, not the outcome. And I think Carol Dweck in The Growth Mindset and that whole concept, she talks a lot about praising the effort, not the outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think whether it's parenting, working out, diet, or whatever, praise the effort that it took to show up for that session and to continue to be consistent over time, instead of, you know, the pounds that you lost or whatever, because that's going to fluctuate. What isn't going to fluctuate, you can control showing up each day for the most part. And so I think that was a concept I want to just come back to is, making sure that you celebrate the effort and not the outcome. But short-term memory for setbacks, that's one of my favorites, because setbacks, like we mentioned, the obstacles are inevitable. And I think you can dwell and you can live in that setback, or you can learn from it, move past it, and continue to move forward. And so I always say you want to fail fast, you want to fail forward. And if you can continue to do that, you're going to actually grow faster and, you know, get to where you want to go faster. Because like I said, failure is part of the journey. Failure is a necessary part of the journey. And failure fuels freedom. Failure fuels, you know, all of these progressions. And, you know, when you work out, you are breaking down your muscle, and then over time it gets better. When you do a lot of things, it's almost you have to take a micro step back if you want to go forward, because that micro step back is where all of the progress and everything occurs. And it's the same thing with recovery. When you do a workout, you're actually getting worse. But when you sleep, when you take care of your mind, when you take care of all the things you need to, nutrition, all that, your body is adapting and getting stronger, because it's like, oh, the next time I face this thing, I'm going to be ready for it. And so I think failure is something we need to become friends with. Failure is something that we need to understand that, again, it's inevitable. And the more we can do it and the faster we can do it, the more we're going to grow, the more we're going to progress, the more we're going to develop as a person and in our health.
I love it, man. That concludes the 7 keys to unlocking consistency. Number 1 being willpower. Number 2 being the product of the right development. Number 3, progress over perfection. Number 4, spot roadblocks. Number 5, control what you can control. Number 6, celebrate success the right way. And number 7, short-term memory for setbacks. Anything else you'd love to add in the world of consistency?
No, I think that that pretty much sums it up, but I'll definitely just put a stamp on consistency is everything. It's the most important variable to me, and it is more important than intensity. It's more important than perfection. And if you can stay consistent with something, that's what's ultimately going to yield to progression, growth, development. And so I think we need to shift the narrative, because I think a lot of the health and wellness world is around perfection, is around reaching an outcome, is around intensity. And what we really need to shift it to is, how can you show up each and every day? Mm-hmm. And not show up for somebody else, show up for yourself, because it's all about that self-respect. It's all about proving that you are who you say you are. And that will help not only you reach the goals physically, but mentally, which I think is almost more important, your self-image and how you view yourself in the world.
I love the way you said that around showing up for yourself. And I can't help it, man. I've been looking at this post that you put up, I think in the middle of January. And it says, it's around the concept of confidence. And it says 30 miles, 120 laps, 4 cramps, 3 Uncrustables, 2 Clif bars, and 80 ounces of water. No, this wasn't a race. It wasn't a competition. There was no crowd clapping for me. I didn't have any help. It was just me and the track. Why? And then you wrote, because sometimes you have to prove to yourself that you are who you say you are. And that man, like, round of applause for you. And like, I'm just going to take the metaphor from that. Like, that is getting into the cold plunge. That is doing the next right thing. That is making the choice for whole foods over the processed foods. That is treating people appropriately, even when you're stressed because somebody hit you or you got a fender bender or traffic was bad. Didn't get good sleep last night. That one sits well with me, man. Will you kind of discuss your relationship with confidence and why you think it's so important to do hard things? Because something that I think about when I do hard things, all I think about is that thing. It's like a mini vacation from the world for a little while in pursuit of trying to overcome adversity. Even though it sucks in the moment, like you said, I never regret it when I do it. And on the other side, typically you've learned something, you've explored something, you've tested something, you've built some depth in the relationships with people that you embarked with. And the most important relationship being that with yourself.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this is one that it's a constant battle. It's an everyday battle. And I think doing hard things for me is doing it with me in a crowd of one, so that when I face, you know, the adversity that will inevitably hit me outside of, you know, in life, I'll be prepared for that and I'll be prepared to face it. Cause it's like, hey, I've already done this hard thing. I've already done this hard thing. You raise your stress threshold. You raise your threshold of what you can handle, what you can deal with. And so why not put yourself through it? Why wait for the life to teach you the lessons? Why not teach the lessons yourself? And so, yeah, for me, it's always been, I always come back to this quote, and I don't know if it's my quote or who said it, but I show myself what's possible by striving for the impossible. Mm. And so I won't know what I'm capable of unless I explore those edges. And how could you, like, when you go to bed at night, when you wake up each day, how could you know that you're leaving, you know, potential on the table? And for me, I don't want to leave any potential on the table. We get this one life. And, you know, with that, I want to squeeze all the juice out of it that I can, and not in a, oh my God, I have to be optimizing every second of my life, but in a way that's, how can I push myself creatively? How can I push myself physically? How can I push myself mentally? And with that, you have to think about, it's all unique to the person. The way I push myself is not going to work for you or somebody else. It might, but ultimately it's personal to you. And I think Michael Easter has this concept of the Misogi that's getting big nowadays, which is kind of doing something that's really, really hard and challenging, but not publicizing it, not posting it, not looking for, you know, an applause or anything. And so one day I kind of had this idea, and I'll actually give you the story of last year. So last year I wanted to go on my own Masogi journey. And so you're really not supposed to tell anybody, but I told my wife because, you know, obviously I live with her 24/7, and I tried to run a mile a day, but I tried to increase all the way until I got 26 miles. So let me explain that better. I tried to run 1 mile, and the next day, 2 miles, the next day, 3 miles until I got to 26. Now, for some, that might be pretty easy, or not pretty easy, but easier if you're an ultra endurance runner. I had not run over 6 miles in my entire life. And so I, in my head, was like, the Masogi is supposed to be something that 50% you might fail, 50% you might succeed. And so I thought, I don't know if I can do that, but I would love to try. I'm not a, you know, long distance runner, but I'll go for it. And so I set off for this journey, and come mile 12 or day 12, I started to get some pain in my ankle, and I was like, all right, you know, whatever, it's pain. I've dealt with that. I'm a basketball player. We're good. And come mile 16, my leg completely blew up. I don't know what my injury was, but I could not walk for about 3 days. And again, I'm not wishing this upon anybody. I'm not saying that, oh, you should go out and do something super physical, or, you know, David Goggins it or whatever. But what did I learn from that? I thought I could only run 6 miles or 10 miles. I got up to 16 in consecutive days. I was able to run a half marathon at, 7:30 pace. I was able to do these things that never in my entire life did I even think was possible. And so for me, it was like I explored the edge and realized, oh, dang, I got a couple more steps. I can keep going. There's more there. I'm not even at the edge yet. And so fast forward to this year, I wanted to just hop on a track and run until I couldn't run anymore. And that happened to be 30 miles. And I will say it wasn't consecutive. I had to stop, cramped up a couple of times. Mm. So I had to stop. I had to, you know, deal with that. I had to hydrate. But to get past the marathon when, you know, the most I had run at that point was 16 miles. So again, it's just, I show myself what's possible by striving for the impossible. I don't think it has to be physical. I use these examples because they're easy to understand, but there are many, many other things that I've done, whether it's social media detox, whether it's, going, reading a certain amount in a certain amount of days, whatever it is, find your thing. But, I think ultimately all of these things have helped me. So now in the real world, when I face challenge, when, I'll use an example of this trip, we missed our flight, you know, a connection to New Zealand. And instead of stressing about what I can't control, which is we missed the flight, it's okay, what can I handle right now? That's finding food, getting a hotel, getting ready for our travel tomorrow, making sure we don't miss our flight the next day. But it didn't stress me out. It's not something that I was panicking
about.
It's
solution-based orientation as opposed to like marinating in the negative. It's really easy to sit there and stew over the thing that went wrong or the pain of your leg or failing. But it sounds to me that you have experience with adversity, failure, and discomfort that now you're like, okay, how do I make the next best decision? Or how do I manage this scenario as best as possible? So that way we're pre-planning and preparing so that this doesn't happen again. And that is very cool. I like the Masogi concept. We were fortunate to connect with Michael Easter on a special conversation around his book, not the scarcity brain, but the first one around,
the comfort crisis.
Yeah, the comfort crisis. And he's big into rucking now and gets outside all the time. And it's very cool. And there's a book you probably would like. It's called The 12-Hour Walk by Colin O'Brady. That's another really cool one that I think would land on your radar based on the Masogi concept, which is cool. There's something I want to toss your way, and that is taking care of your body is a form of respect you owe to yourself. And that's not always something that I think people think about. I think the mental concept is what can I get away with? And then I'm going to work out just to keep getting away with the thing or just so that I can stay just ahead of, you know, whatever great genetics I have or just keep my blood panel good enough where I can just stay off of medication. What comes to mind when I mention the form of self-respect you owe yourself in relation to taking care of your body?
The Trident family taught me something really important this last year.
that we are all a bundle of stories, both good, bad, and everything in between. All of their cold brews remind their customers that they are part of something bigger than themselves. I start my day with the Sweet Cream Cold Brew as I am prepping my mind and body for fitness, service, coaching, and podcasting. With various locations in San Diego, they offer over 14 nitro cold brews and a variety of specialty drinks. You can find the perfect brew and pair it with one of their treats from the Keto Bakery. You can check them out over at tridentcoffee.com and use code ALLSMITH to take your coffee experience to the next level.
Yeah, that's powerful. I think what comes to mind for me is my kind of reason for pursuing health and helping people pursue health is I want people to be able to do what they want, when they want, how they want, at the level that they want to. Because a lot of the time, you know, you see people, their life is restricted based on their health, and you never want that to be the case. And, you know, the best thing you can give someone is the ability to do and experience whatever they want. And I think that could be, you know, going on a hike with your kids. That can be getting up early in the morning. That could be, you know, doing, you know, a challenging race or whatever the case is. But if you don't even have access to being able to do that, you're missing out on, you know, a huge chunk of life. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, we've heard the cliche that like health is wealth, but think about the investment that you can make in yourself to, you know, ultimately be able to spend that wealth in whatever way that you want. And it's like, you know what? I want to wake up today and I want to go run a 5K. Like, okay, cool. To have the ability to do that is a blessing. And I think ultimately, you know, we live in a world now where people don't think about their health until something's wrong. People don't, it's like, I go on a diet once I realize I'm gaining weight. Oh, I need to focus on my sleep when it's, I see my energy slumping. And that's already not that it's too late, but that's kind of a reactive, you know, way to approach things. And with me, I want to be proactive. I want to be ahead of the game. I want to be in a state where I'm not looking at my doctor and nervous and being like, oh my God, what is he going to tell me? It's like, I know these things and I understand that I'm taking care of everything that I can take care of. And I think ultimately you have genetics, you have things that you can't control that are going to predispose you, but why would you not want to stack the deck in your favor? Why would you not want to play the best hand that you can play with the cards that you're dealt by taking care of these things? And again, it looks different for everyone. And I'm not saying everybody has to be on a strict diet, get 8 hours of sleep every night, you know, have a crazy workout plan, but what is it that you can do consistently that's going to improve your life experience so that you can experience more of life? And so I think, you know, it's you really want to, you know, live a life that you love and kind of, you know, love that way that you're living it. And for me, I love eating healthy. I love working out. I love these things because I found things that I've loved within those categories. And again, it's going to look different for every person. But find your thing, find your way that you can enjoy it and trust the process and stick with it, because, you know, everything is going to be a process in this life. And the more that you can understand and embrace that, show up each day for yourself, I think it's going to pay dividends in what you kind of get back from those investments.
Love it, man. You've made a lifelong pursuit of redefining what it means to be healthy. And a while back, you systemized this and you call it the Vitality System. How did that concept come to be? And what eventually led to the development of the book?
Yeah, so a lot. I think my whole life kind of culminated in this book. And I'll start by saying I've always been in love with this word vitality. And something about it, you don't hear it often. It's kind of mentioned in circles of, oh, I want to have health and vitality, but not a lot of people know what it means or understand what vitality is. And so for me, you know, vitality, I'll define it. It's, you know, kind of strength and energy. And I think the other definition is the power giving continuance to life, present in all living things. And I kind of just fell in love with this word of energy and the power giving continuance to life. And so I was like, okay, how can I take a step back and understand how I can create something that isn't just going to attack one piece of the issue. Because you look across the board, movement, people have issues. We don't move enough. 80% of people don't meet physical activity requirements. You go to nutrition, you know, there's over, I think, 500,000 deaths just based on poor nutrition a year. That's staggering. Then you move on to recovery. 1 in 3 people don't get enough sleep. Then you move on to lifestyle and the mental health issues that we have. And so for me, what I wanted to do was take all of these concepts and turn it into a system and have frameworks that are understandable and digestible for people. So for me, it started with what are the main pillars of health, wellness, performance, and longevity? And again, this is semantics. You can bucket them however you want to bucket them. I wanted to bucket them in these core 4 pillars to help people easier understand what they are and how they can think about them. So for me, it was movement, nutrition, recovery, and lifestyle. Movement, how you move, exercise, that makes sense. Nutrition, same thing, your diet, the foods you eat. Recovery is one that people don't usually understand. I bucket sleep, breathing, immunity, a lot of things in recovery. But the way I define it is your body's ability to adapt and return to a balance or enhanced state of mind, strength, and energy. So how does your body adapt and return to that, you know, state that you were before? And then lifestyle, which again, hard to come up with the word to encompass emotion, motivation, stress, mindset. I use lifestyle, which some people, again, it's semantics, but it's basically how you live and how you show up. So this kind of bucketed everything into, all right, I have all of the things that you need to know in order to live active, healthy, and happy life. You have movement, nutrition, recovery, and lifestyle. Underneath those umbrellas, there's a lot to unpack. And I think it's overwhelming for people. It's daunting to understand that, oh man, I got to take care of my nutrition. I got to sleep right. I got to do meditation. I got to do breath work. And so what I really wanted to do with this book is bring things back to a simple, practical place. How can you understand the baseline knowledge? How can you have frameworks, strategies, principles that you can come back to and understand how to execute in each of these categories? So first things first, it was the baseline knowledge. I'm going to tell you about exercise. I'm going to tell you about the types of exercise. I'm going to tell you about nutrition, nutrients, what, so you can understand, because if you have a better understanding, you're not only going to be more consistent and adhere more, but it's just going to click better for you. If you understand, oh, I need more protein because I need, you know, a gram per pound of body weight because I'm an active person or whatever. And so I think the more you understand, the easier it is to execute on certain behaviors. And so basically for me, it was, how do I take all of this information and make it digestible, make it actionable? But also in the health and wellness industry, I've never really seen a book that puts everything into one and talks about all of these concepts in a way that's approachable for a superstar athlete, for a medical student, and for the general population who doesn't know anything about health and wellness. How could I create a book that I can hand to them and say, hey, you can take 1, 2, or 50 things from this book that you can apply to make your life better, to live more active, healthy, and happy? So that's my short. Obviously, it wasn't even that short, but I could talk for hours, days, weeks about the Vitality System.
No, I think what you created is spot on, man. I love that it's variable in the sense that it does hit many different demographics, from a professional athlete to somebody just beginning their health journey. There are things that people can take away. And I also very much appreciate that you picked kind of 4 boxes to play in, being your core 4.
Yeah.
And then you kind of define each one of those within some subcategories. And I want to start with movement. And the majority of the world thinks of movement as just going to the gym or doing a run. And there's this preconceived notion of what movement is, but you and I both know motion is lotion, baby. There's a lot of things. I mean, blinking is movement, thinking is movement, drinking a cup of water is movement, walking is movement, obviously exercise. How do you educate people around movement and trying to help create buy-in around things that are consistent for people?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with movement is everything. Like, movement is what makes life life. Like, it's like without movement, life doesn't exist. It's like there is nothing going on around you. And I think we've made movement into exercise. Like, people think, oh, movement is exercise, and that's what it's synonymous with. That's what people equate it to. And what that has done is it's discounted standing more. It's discounted walks. It's discounted going using the stairs. And people think, okay, if I get my hour of exercise in, that's check. I check the box for movement. And ultimately, what you do in the other 23 hours matters way more, burns way more calories, is way more important for your health than that 1 hour. And exercise is so important. It's one of the biggest levers that we have for improving our health and wellness. But I think ultimately how you move throughout the day is where the real gold lies that people haven't really explored. And I think for that, what I tried to do in this chapter is really open up people's view of what movement is, where movement exists, and where it can exist. And I think with that, it's understanding how the body works. It's understanding how to use your body, how to assess movement and all of those different things. You don't have to be an expert, but understanding all of these things can help you put together a movement program for yourself that is, you know, one that you enjoy, one that's frequent enough, one that is at the intensity that it needs to be, and all of those things so you can continue to move throughout your life. So I really want people to think about everything outside of exercise. And I do spend a great bit of time on exercise and the different types of exercise and all that. But really where the gold lies is in the everything else outside of exercise. And how can we bolster those things? How can we inject movement into the other areas of our life? Because, you know, before the last 100, 200 years, it was injected into every part of our lives. And it was something that was a staple. And it wasn't, there was no exercise. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go to the gym. It was, no, I work and I'm active during work. I'm active in how I get to work. I'm active in what I do outside of work. I'm active in living life. And I think that's where we need to get back to, is kind of merging the concept of exercise and movement again.
Yeah, it's like we talked about with Michael Easter. Comfort is the crisis. And I think how you spend your time is how you spend your life. And very, very quickly summarized with your words there, movement is life. We need things moving within our internal organ system, our heart, our blood flow. And something that comes to mind in relation to movement is people overemphasize intensity, and they think standing, oh, that doesn't count. Or, hey, I parked a little bit further from the entrance to the grocery store, and then I also walked to put my grocery cart away, which is a very popular topic for me specifically. Yep. Those are extra steps. Something that I love right now is like the Garmin and the step counters, because it's gamifying it for people to get extra movement within their day. But like you said, like, when you look at the allocation of time, if there's 23 hours and you're spending 8 of those hours, hopefully sleeping, hopefully one of those hours is dedicated to exercise that maybe is higher intense in comparison to just day-to-day activities of daily living. What's going on in those other hours that are allocated? Can we stand up and move? Or can we do something that I really love, which I call it microdosing fitness? You call it fitness snacks. And I really appreciate those. I always love doing them, like during the Super Bowl, because I see how jacked the guys are in the game. So every commercial, while I'm like getting a couple laughs, knock out a set of push-ups or knock out a set of air squats. Yep. And I typically try to pick one thing. And I've seen you talk about this before. It's such a great thing to do, whether you're using the Pomodoro technique of your workflow throughout the day, like, hey, once an hour, let's do 5 burpees. And just when you look at the volume accumulation that's come across a day, across a week, across a month, across a year, and across a lifespan, movement is significantly increased by just integrating these little fitness snacks. How did you kind of come up with that technique? And how do you deliver that to people where they're like, huh, that sounds like something I can do. And it seems easy. And then you get down to do like the first rep and you're all sticky.
Yeah, no, it's a great concept. And I've heard Andy Galpin, I've heard Andrew Huberman talk about exercise snacks. I've called them exercise snacks, fitness snacks, random acts of exercise. And, you know, people on the streets or my wife probably think I'm crazy because I love kind of getting into something by doing a little bit of exercise. And I think the perfect example for me is reading. Obviously, reading takes some activation energy to really get and focus. A lot of times you read the first paragraph, you're like, wait, my mind wasn't even there. I don't even know what I was just looking at words on a page.
It's the blood flow to really narrow your mind for sure.
So yeah, for me, I'll get down, I'll do some push-ups, I'll do some squats. And what that does is it gets me kind of activated and ready. And then I'm kind of, the blood's flowing, I'm focused. And so I inject that into so many areas of life. I'll be writing and I can feel myself getting a little sluggish or whatever. And it's like, all right, hop off the desk, do some squats, do some push-ups or do whatever. Go on a walk. I think people, oh my God, they underestimate walking and the power of walking, not just for the physical benefits. The mental benefits for me far outweigh the physical.
The change of scenery, I think, is crucial as well. Change of energy. I mean, yes. There is something, man, to the human experience that doesn't quite meet the eye. And I think being able to get a change of energy when you're feeling a little bit stuck or pigeonholed, especially in the form of reading or writing, it does just stimulate some of those brain waves to operate or upgrade a little bit, or give you the feedback of, that's enough for today. I need to let this breathe for a little bit, and then I'll revisit it tomorrow.
Yep. And I think with the walks, if you can, obviously in nature are even better. If you can, leave your phone behind. All of those things, because ultimately, what do we do when we get bored? We reach for our phone.
Yeah.
We reach for the TV. And I think that is ultimately stimulating a different part of your brain, and it's keeping all the – if you can just unplug and let your brain relax and rest, it's actually going to create connections. It's going to prune connections that it doesn't need. And it's going to fuel you. So when you get back inside and you have to work or you have to write or you have to do something productive, you gave your brain some time to unpack everything that it's been doing and kind of just, you know, turn off for a little bit. And so for me, I think these exercise snacks and these random acts of exercise, you can place them wherever you want to place them. It doesn't have to be scheduled. It doesn't have to be something that's like, oh, I'm going to do this, this, and this every day. It's just something that kind of helps you take care of your body mentally and physically. And it puts you in a place that you can continue to do the things that you love at a higher level because your body is ready for those things.
Yeah. It's like plugging in the iPhone for a second. It's a little recharge,
right?
Get the juices flowing a little bit. And another thing that I think is important, I call it MVD, minimal viable dose. It's something you can actually do that does make your life better immediately. So you do get that immediate reward rather than practicing the constant art of delayed gratification. And I think those types of fitness snacks are things that will not only make people more productive in their day to day, but will make their bodies hurt a little bit less. We'll get some changes in frequency, fluctuation, rate, pace, all the different variables. Yeah. And I really appreciated when I saw that. I was like, oh, yeah, we definitely got to touch on that when I have him on the show. The next thing I want to talk about, man, like I understand the concept now of the vitality system. I love the core four of movement, nutrition, recovery, and lifestyle. And we'll unpack nutrition, recovery, and lifestyle in a second because we just kind of played with movement. But I think everybody's sitting on the couch with an idea. Everybody has generalized knowledge, but creating the structure is hard. You've mentioned you're still working on some of these things, but your book is self-published, man. It's a labor of love. Yeah. It's not like you had some production person holding your hand and guiding you through the process and telling you, hey, I need at least 500 words a day. Then we're going to go through and edit it. Then we're going to structure it. Here are the chapters. Here are the subtitles. Here's the, you know, how we're going to bullet out everything so it's easy for people to consume. How did you take this huge world of knowledge and figure out how to put it together that was seamless for people? Because you mentioned to me it was a labor of love because friends, family, and everybody in between started asking the same questions. And you wanted to have a tool that would make their life better.
Yeah, it's there was no big juicy contract that's like, if you write this book, we'll pay you this much or whatever. For me, the concept that I always come back to is I want the information to win. It's not about me. It's about the information winning and helping people and empowering people. And so all of the information from the book comes from my experience with clients, the best minds in the world that I've read their books, read their studies, listen to their podcasts, whatever. And ultimately, all of the experiences that I've gathered, foraged for, disseminate, like everything is packaged in that. And I didn't want to make it all science. I didn't want to make it all my life. I didn't want to make it all antidotes. I wanted to make it a combination of all of those things, because I think you can turn up the science dial too much and people tune out. You can turn up the, oh, this is all about me and my life, and people tune out. So how can you kind of create something that, hey, it's not about me. This is about giving you a tool that you can adapt. And I think you mentioned it earlier, a big part of this book is its adaptability. It's not one book, one program for one person. It is a system that adapts to you. So ultimately, if you are 45 years old with 3 kids and you have a hardworking job, it can adapt to you. If you're an athlete that's in college that wants to get better at playing your sport, it can adapt to you. And I think that's where it's different from traditional books out there. I'm not selling you, oh, use the Vitality program. It's going to help you lose weight in 40 days. It is a tool for you to understand yourself better so you can prescribe the things that you need, so you can understand what steps you need to take. And man, that took a long, long time of just sitting with some of these ideas, understanding all the information that I had at my disposal and iterating. It's an iterative process. And I think one of the things that was really one of the big portions of this book is what I call the foundational principles. And it's basically how to go about meaningful and sustainable behavior change. And this was one of the main concepts where this separates kind of my book from just being able to go online and search information. Because one, people don't do that usually. And two, people who have the information, people know they need to sleep more, eat more vegetables, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't mean they apply it. What they need is a system with actionable, practical strategies, frameworks, and principles. So what I call the foundational principles is quick, it's easy, it's 5 E words. So it's education, first understanding, baseline knowledge of what you want to change in the subjects. Then it's exploration. You have to explore this thing in your context. So, I use weight loss as an example. You have to explore the different strategies. You have to explore what's out there. What have you done already? Next, after that exploration, is experimenting. This is one of the most important stages. Trying things. You have to do things you've never done to get things you've never had. And I think that's a hard concept for people to understand, is like, oh, I'm going to basically just do what I've always been doing and maybe tweak one small thing. Or no, you have to make changes if you want to see big changes. The common one is, how long did it take you to gain the 5, 10 pounds or the freshman 15 or whatever? Maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. Do you think you're going to get that back in 30 days and you're going to lose that weight in 30 days and keep it off? No, it's going to take 6 months, a year, 2 years, and you have to sustain that. So I think experimenting is testing, is analyzing, is iterating. After that, the fourth is execution. And we've talked about this one a lot. So you have to continuously implement and execute. Show up for yourself each and every day, or else what you worked for is going to fall off if you stop doing what it took to get you there. And then the last one is my favorite, is evolution. What you do now is going to have to change. Your life is going to change. Change is the only constant in life. So it's like, what you're doing now is obviously going to have to adapt because your life is going to adapt. So can you continuously review, refine, and restructure what you're doing to fit what your life is right now? So I'll repeat them: education, exploration, experimentation, execution, and then evolving, evolution. So I kind of break this down in the book and how to use these stages, how to progress through these stages. They're not sequential. You don't have to go from education to exploration. You can go from education to execution, back to experimentation to evolution. All of them are not sequential, but what you have to understand is each of these is integral to change and sustainable and meaningful behavior change if you follow those steps.
The five E's. Just out of curiosity, yes, as we segue back to the topic of the core four and move in towards nutrition, a big major polarizing and controversial topic right now in the world of weight loss is Ozempic, the weight loss drug.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you've worked in the supplement space before and you mentioned, hey, it took you 4 years to gain all this weight. But then human psychology wants to know, hey, what's the surgery? What's the supplement I can take, or what's the injection or the injectable that I can use to help me get back to where I was, or rapid styles of improvement? But they come with side effects.
Yeah.
And I recently had a naturopath on and we discussed all about peptides. It's just interesting to me that Ozempic, with a ton of just dangers associated with gut health, gut microbiome, and side effects associated on the backside of long-term use, is now approved by the federal government. But then we see things like BPC-157, a regenerative drug for not just gut health, but also tendon and ligament issues, and then other things that are precursors to human growth hormone like CJC-1295. I'm speaking, you know, in science terms right now, but I'm sure you can gather a little bit. What are your thoughts on that? It's a very controversial topic. You know, a lot of people are going to be torn, but in my opinion, the definition of intelligence is when a person can argue the other side, even if they don't agree. And I love leaning into some of these controversial topics because it's not making sense to me, but it makes sense from a business and marketing standpoint that, hey, we're going to use this weight loss drug. It's going to make the healthcare system a lot of money, but it's not safe. And that raises the question, is it healthcare or is it sick care? Or is it pushing people towards sickness so they can monetize?
Yeah. Like you said, it's a very polarizing topic. And I think it needs to be addressed. And I love the science educators out there who will address some of these big issues, or the people that will say, I don't know. And or that will say, I would love to learn more about that. And I think a lot of people nowadays, they want to say that they have the solution. They want to say that their thing is the thing. And they sit on this hill that if data comes out that kind of proves everything that they're talking about wrong, it's like they stay on that hill and they die on that hill. And for me, like I said, the information should always win. And so I think with these, you know, drugs like Ozempic, if that is the consistent solution that's going to help your situation in the long term, sure, it should be a solution for some. I think what it's doing is presenting quick fix type, you know, narrative around it, where it's like, oh, I can do this quick fix thing, solve my problems. People love to pay for something because they feel like they gave something and they're getting something back, when instead they know it's the work, it's the consistency, it's the thing. So I would never want people to try to put a Band-Aid on a bullet hole and try to, you know, kind of cover something up by paying for it. I think ultimately, whether you take Ozempic or not, something else is going to leak. Something else is going to happen. It's just, again, you don't want to continue to just put those Band-Aids on things. You want to address the root cause. So what is it that is causing you to want to take Ozempic for weight loss or blood sugar control or whatever? Why is that, you know, issue exists? Back it up, find the root cause of that problem and address that. I think ultimately that's where we need to be. And of course, it's making so much money that it's not going to go anywhere. But I do think we need to understand all of these tools and where they fit into the toolbox. And I think, you know, obesity is, you know, a massive epidemic right now. You know, 2 in 3 people are overweight or obese. And that's a scary thing to kind of look at in this world. But I do think we're skipping the fundamentals and jumping to these quick fix solutions instead of starting at the baseline of, why does this problem exist? How can I address it with behavioral interventions first or nutritional interventions first before I jump to the drug, to the supplement, to the, you know, whatever service product that's out there? And so I think it's a scary transition, but we have people out there that are fighting the good fight, that are trying to address these issues at the root of the problem. I just think we need more voices out there. We need more people educating and helping people understand that unless you want to take Ozempic for the rest of your life, which obviously we wouldn't recommend if there's side effects and negatives that come with it, why would you even take it in the first place? Because as soon as you stop taking it, it's going to, all those things are going to come back. And so a lot of things, I've worked a lot with corporate wellness, and now you're seeing actual corporate wellness offerings, like offering Ozempic. And it's like, I think what you see is people take Ozempic, they love it. They're like, oh my God, this is great. And they think, all right, problem solved, I'll stop. And boom, everything comes back. So now what you see is corporate wellness offerings are Ozempic plus behavior change, because it's like, you need to have something that helps wean people off, and you need to, so why not just start with the behavior change? And I think that's kind of where we lie. And it's a convoluted system. It's one that, you know, there's a lot of money in it. So it's going to be hard to, you know, go back on it, but ultimately that's the world we live in right now.
Damn, that was well said. That's something I really like about long form communication and conversation like podcasts, yeah, is we have the opportunity to paint full context, right? And what is something you did as a child that you no longer do as an adult? For many, that answer is play. RX Smart Gear allows for your daily workouts to turn into play and exploration. In my training, the Frevo rope gives me access to a versatile rope that I can take with me wherever I go. On the road, at the beach, to the park, or playing at home, RX Smart Gear jump ropes fit my needs. We at AllSmith trust RX Smart Gear. Their gear is always reliable and gives me peace of mind that I will have top-notch equipment to support my health and fitness journey. Hop on over to RX Smart Gear and use the discount code AllSmith to shop their latest cutting-edge gear. Have your gear work with you and not against you.
We're not on here saying Ozempic is bad. We're saying that it's a tool.
No.
And it should be known that it is typically for weight loss and blood sugar regulation, but that it also, or and, it comes with side effects. Yep. And so as long as people are aware of that and they're utilizing it as a tool appropriately with an honest doctor prescription, not a monetary doctor prescription, I think it can be something that has potential good use. But I also want to go into habits and behavior change, as you described, because the magic that you're looking for is in the work that you're avoiding. And if you're somebody that's just trying to take Ozempic because you don't want to fix your habits, you want to keep smashing the ice cream at nighttime and making poor choices consistently, that does cause extreme variability or fluctuation within blood sugar of peaks and valleys. That's a dangerous uphill battle that you may get away with it in the short term, but long term, it's going to cost you your health and potentially some of your freedoms. And so I just wanted to touch on that. I knew you were the right guy to tackle that conversation with. And that brings us to the conversation of nutrition, right? Like, I've recently had a few different nutritionists on the podcast, and now there's so much conflicting knowledge, Kyle. Like, is it carnivore? Is it paleo? Is it vegan? Is it a combination? Is it a Mediterranean style? Like, what's right? What's wrong? Everybody wants to pick sides. Everybody has their case studies. And the number one thing that I've heard, if I were to give my brief advice, eat whole foods. Try your best to have single ingredient or limited ingredient foods. If it comes out of a bag or a box, it's probably not the best. If it has an unlimited shelf life, it's probably not the best. Try your best to shop the perimeter of the grocery store. And if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. And then the last thing that I really like is kind of try to eat the rainbow, get some variants and different micronutrients within your system. And over the course of doing that and having limited ingredients ingested into your mouth, I think you come to realize like, oh, when I have this food, I actually feel pretty good. When I have this food, I get a little bit of digestive distress, a little bloated, and you know, my stool sample is not as clean and efficient. And so I think taking this personal inventory through trial and error and gradually introducing things is probably the best approach. That's not like this diet or that diet or picking sides like we talked about as far as like programs that are being delivered now.
Yeah. Yeah. Nutrition, man. Wow. What a topic. What a just, it's very sad to see that it's such a polarizing thing and that people always want to, you know, promote their thing as the best thing or their thing as the only thing. And that you can, and I think one of the best people at educating people on nutritional sciences, I love Lane Norton. He kind of cuts through to the data, to the science. And again, he lets the information win. He changes his beliefs if new data comes out. But ultimately, any diet will work if you adhere to it and if you're consistent to it. Obviously, it's more about the caloric deficit. It's more about, when it comes to weight loss, it's more about the caloric deficit. And I have never gotten so many questions about any other topic besides nutrition. Like, nutrition is the one I get the most questions on. And for me, writing this chapter was one of the hardest because ultimately there's so much red tape around areas. And I wanted to portray that it's not about one way or another. It's about understanding which foods are, you know, healthy, understanding portion control, understanding the different tools you have at your disposal. So quickly, what I tried to break it down into, and there's obviously a bunch of, you know, different chapters on micronutrients, macronutrients, energy balance, hydration, but my favorite chapter is the one on nutritional frameworks, because I think there are a couple ways to look at nutrition. And I broke it down into what you eat or don't eat, when you eat or don't eat, how you eat or how much you eat or don't eat, and then lastly, why you eat or don't eat. So with those, it's basically what you eat. That is obviously what you're consuming. And I think most people with this, it's dietary restriction. So when they go for weight loss, what you eat, it's like, oh, I'm not going to eat carbs, or oh, I'm not going to eat meat, or oh, I'm not going to eat X, Y, or Z. So that's kind of the what you eat category. And manipulating that variable is what a lot of diets are based on: keto, paleo, carnivore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a good framework to look at with what you eat is, I call it subtraction by addition. And a lot of the times, actually adding in healthy foods is a better strategy than taking away unhealthy foods. Because when you're taking away, there's a negative context to that. And a lot of the times when it's like, I'm deprived of something, you're resentful, you're not happy. But when you add in healthier foods, you ultimately crowd out some of the bad foods. And like you said, your taste buds will start to adapt, and a strawberry starts tasting like a dessert instead of having a strawberry milkshake or a strawberry cake or whatever the case might be. And so that's kind of the concept around what you eat. When it comes to when you eat, we all know intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, that has become big. And I think, again, like everything else we've talked about, it's a tool. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, everybody should intermittent fast, everybody should eat within an 8-hour window. It's a tool. If it works for you, that's great. And you should use it. And if you can be consistent with it, more power to you, you should use it. And I think with intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, one of the things we run into a lot is malnutrition. So people aren't getting enough protein. People aren't getting the necessary nutrients. They're eating less, but they're actually, you know, doing worse because they're not getting the necessary nutrients that they need or their body needs to thrive and be successful. So I would say caution with that. If you're doing intermittent fasting or time restricted feeding, make sure you're getting the necessary protein, make sure you're getting the necessary nutrients that you need within that window. Then you move on to how you eat and how much you eat. So how much you eat is probably one of the biggest problems we have in America. Portion sizes have, you know, quadrupled in the past, I don't know if it's 10 or 15, 20 years, but ultimately we're eating way more than we need to. And we eat so fast, we eat distracted, we eat while driving, we eat in every scenario. And I think this is taking it away from actually being in tune with your body. When you eat slowly, when you're eating in a community, when you're actually enjoying and tasting and chewing your food, you actually understand, oh, wow, I'm getting a little full. Like, I should probably slow down or I should stop. Instead, we eat so fast that we blow through those signals. And next thing you know, we're eating cake and we're eating the tub of ice cream or whatever the case might be. So I think with how you eat and how much you eat, it's about portion control. It's about understanding what your body needs, and it's about eating mindfully. And we hear that a lot, but you know, eating slowly, putting your fork down, making sure that you're not distracted while eating, those things make a huge difference in how that food actually is absorbed, how that food's processed, and how your body utilizes it. So the last one is why you eat. And this one's kind of can be confusing to some people, but the way I like to put it is there's a lot of emotions surrounding food. We eat sometimes when we're happy, we eat when we celebrate, we eat when we're sad. And so you have to understand the certain triggers you have to eat. And one of the biggest triggers that I've helped a lot of clients with is boredom. We eat when we're bored, and if there's nothing else to do, it's like, oh, let me go grab a snack. Let me open the refrigerator. How many times have you just opened the refrigerator and you're like, I don't even know why I'm looking for food right now. I think I'm just bored. And so a lot of the times, if we can kind of understand those triggers and maybe insert a walk, maybe insert reading, or maybe insert, I'm going to eat an apple instead of, you know, the chips that I have laying around, whatever the case might be, understanding why you eat and the factors that lead you to eat will really, really help you understand. And this is where I came up with that concept of out of sight, out of mind, and shifting it to in view, easy to pursue. Because if you have the apple in view, or if you have the fruit on the elevated level of the refrigerator so you can see it instead of tucked away in the drawer where you don't see it and it goes bad after 3 days, that's kind of going to make it easier to make those decisions. And it's going to make it easier to focus on building the right environment instead of having to use willpower to not eat those chips that are right there on the counter, or not eat the cake that you bought last night that you didn't want to eat more, but you just brought it home anyway. So again, how can you make things in view, easy to pursue, and take the things out of your sight so you can have it out of mind?
I just really love that concept, in view, easy to pursue. I've always thought of it like convenience leads to compliance, right? Like it's easy to have the chips because it's so easy to eat. It's efficient delivery system. You need it with your fingers. You don't need to heat it up. You don't need to cut it. You don't need utensils for it. And so if people in their food prep pursuits cut up their food, easy to digest, easy to get that in, can do it while distracted, technically, even though that's not the goal. Another thing that I think is important is eating to satisfy the tasks of that day, or the energy expenditure that you're looking to use. It's not a perfect one, but it is a good generality, in my opinion, in the sense that you're not eating to be full. You're not eating to fill an empty space. You're eating to live. You're eating for the nutritious density that's going to allow you to do all the things that you love. And I don't necessarily think that that's a parameter to be memorized, but it's a concept that I think if people wrap their head around, allows for a little bit better decision making. I think that you did a really good job narrowing that. And then the last thing that's associated with nutrition is hydration. And like we're seeing a lot of talk around like salt. We're seeing Relight, we're seeing Element. Will you touch on that a little bit and what it means to get electrolytes and sodium into your system, and how that can help with better muscle pumps, better energy, and this less reliance on caffeine?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they think of hydration, they think of only water. And I think a long time, that's what I thought about too, is like water, water, water. But ultimately, hydration is water plus electrolytes. And your body needs sodium, potassium, magnesium for so many processes in the body, in the brain, in muscle contraction, in nerve conduction, and all of these things. It's like these are the little workers in your body that make these things possible. So if you're deficient, you think about all of the processes in your body and brain that are actually going to be slowed or hampered if you're not getting the necessary electrolytes. And so for me, water is, it's a tool as well. So, obviously the more water you drink, the more you're going to curb your hunger, because a lot of times when we think we're hungry, we're actually just thirsty. Mm-hmm. And so keeping a water bottle handy and around, I always have one somewhere near me, is a great tool for just understanding, okay, am I hungry? Am I thirsty? And all of this comes back to just being in tune with your body. And if you're in tune with your body, you know what you can do, when you can do it, how you can do it. And I think with nutrition, it's huge. It's, when you're hungry. And one of the concepts I tell my wife all the time, and I tell other people, is like, hunger is just a signal. You know, we can go long periods of time without food, but a lot of time when we get that signal, it's immediately eat, go eat, eat something. But if we actually take a step back and process that signal, we can actually learn to understand when we're hungry, when we're thirsty, when we need to eat a lot, when we just need a snack. And I think understanding that signal is huge. And what hydration kind of does for me is helps me curb the hunger, helps me understand, but also just helps me with clarity. So obviously throughout the day, if you're dehydrated, you're going to be less mentally clear. You're going to perform worse, all of those things. So when I'm hydrated, I know I'm performing better. I can be more creative. I can write better, all these different things. And so, yeah, I think shifting the narrative to water plus electrolytes instead of just water is a big conversation that's happening right now. And again, you don't want to go crazy with the sodium and all of that, but understanding that your body needs these nutrients to do a myriad of functions throughout the body is super important.
Yeah, I agree, man. That was great. I feel like we hit the nail on the head there with the nutrition conversation. Yep. Where we'll go next is the recovery conversation. The big pillars there being sleep, breath, immunity, and then I wrote down nervous system regulation, something that we could also tackle. Yep. And you described it on one of your awesome podcast episodes, and that is sleep, highlighting nature's most powerful elixir.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sleep is the most underappreciated, but probably one of the biggest levers that we have in terms of recovery, in terms of health and wellness. And I think so much happens during sleep, but it's such a passive thing. It's not sexy. It's not something you can, you know, market very well, although, you know, companies now like 8Sleep and are doing that very well. But sleep is something that you do and it's in the background. And if you do it right, you notice the difference. But when you do it wrong, it's hard to actually know the difference because sometimes it's become people's norm. So people might have a norm of sleeping 6 hours. So they think that's how they should function each and every day because they're like, oh, like this is how I've always functioned. But they don't understand that, that they're actually at a decrement, that they're actually hurting their health little by little by little. And like I said, 1 in 3 people don't get adequate sleep. And another huge fact is like we spend that same a third of our time asleep in our lives. It's obviously something that evolution has prioritized. It's obviously something that we need. Why else would everybody turn off their brain and be dead to the world for 6 to 8 hours a night? Like it's obviously important. And so what I think is ultimately we have a problem with sleep culture that's getting better. Now you see a lot of recovery wearables. You see 8Sleep and companies promoting this, I'll sleep when I die mentality, but hey, sleep is actually important for health. And that's great. But what I think ultimately it's about is creating the right environment for you and being consistent. And I always tell people the number one sleep tip I give is consistent sleep and wake times. And I think this consistency is hard for people because they have work. So they want to have a Monday through Friday sleep schedule and then a Saturday, Sunday sleep in. But our body is all about circadian rhythms. And I think people are starting to get more educated on circadian rhythms, but there are ideal points for sleep, for blood glucose regulation, for exercise, for eating and all of that, that our bodies cycle through each and every day. The more you can be in tune with that, the higher you can perform, the more optimized you can have with your health. And so I think with sleep, it's all about consistency and your sleep and wake times. And that's kind of the number one thing. But I got sleep tips for days, but I think people have heard most of them. Keep it dark, keep it cool, make sure that you're, you know, doing a warm shower before bed, not looking at blue light, all of that stuff. They're great. But finding what really moves the needle for you is what's important.
I like that. I was just about to ask you kind of like a sleep hygiene recommendation. Do you have like time parameters that you like to play with? I know I've heard different things around like 3 hours before bed, no work, 2 hours before bed, no screen time, and then 1 hour before bed. I forgot what that one was. Do you know that one?
Yeah, it was like, I think it's, you got a couple of them, right? It's like no eating at 2 or 3 hours, no eating 2 hours, no screens, 1 hour, no something. But yeah, the 3-2-1 is super popular. Again, it's all personalized to you. Like, people have kids. Some people have night jobs. Some people have, you know, everybody's situation's different. So again, it's tough to say like, oh, use this method. Yeah. But I do think understanding that one, if you exercise too late, you know, that can be something that can cause your, you know, core temperature to be risen, your heart rate to be risen and all that, which can make it harder to go to sleep. If you eat too close to bed, obviously it's the same thing. Your body's digesting. That's a process that's taking things away from your time to go to sleep. But ultimately it's how do you turn off, you know, turn down distractions, turn down the things that'll keep your brain aroused and turn on the things that'll help you start to transition into sleep. And for me, it's super simple. I keep it the same. And I like to, I think we talked about this a little bit offline, is I like to base behaviors on things that are going to happen every single day. So for me, for the most part, we're going to wake up and go to sleep every single day. So why not structure behaviors around those two things? And so for me, it's like, okay, bedtime's coming up. Make sure I have dinner by a certain time. It's a warm shower. It's reading. It's breath work. It's sleep. And it's like simple. I stack those things every night and I don't miss them, because it's like every night I'm going to have access to all of those things. And so I think for me, it's figuring out what works for you and how to create the best sleep environment for you. And there's a bunch of tools at your disposal. A lot of people get married to the wearables or to, you know, the data that they're getting. But I think subjective measures outweigh objective measures most times. And you can even see it in the data. And you would think like, oh no, taking, you know, a Whoop sleep score and comparing that to your overall feeling of how much energy you have, which is going to be better. People would think, oh, Whoop. But it's actually, you know, been shown that a lot of the time subjective measures outperform objective ones. So trust your gut, trust how you feel. If your Whoop score says that you shouldn't train today, but you feel great, why would you trust a device over how you feel? And the vice versa is the same. If your Whoop says you're ready to go, you should crush it today, but you don't feel great, like, listen to your body. And I think it, again, just with nutrition, it's being in tune with your body. And yeah, I think a lot of people are getting out of tune with their body because they're listening to experts, they're listening to their wearable, they're listening to all these different things, and they don't know what to make of
it. It really is hard to filter all the information. I mean, there are lots of conflicting informations out there. And I mean, you mentioned working out too close to bed can be hindering to sleep as well. What if that's somebody's only choice, right? So like they're getting off work at 6 o'clock, they're in an hour of traffic, and then they get there and they train from 7 to 8:30. You know, I would say personally, like, I'd rather them work out than not work out. And then I would give them, you know, hey, on the drive home, let's toss on the Calm app or the Headspace app to try to get into a lower vibration and allow themselves to downregulate via a meditation in the car. And then, like you said, a great dinner, very nutrient dense, maybe get a little bit of carbs, because then you get the blood sugar spike followed by the crash, which will be great for sleep, a nice warm shower. But it is challenging as far as the sleep component, because there's a lot of volatility in our world. Our world rewards function, our world rewards outcome, and high performance is a big thing. So people are pushing all day. And then at nighttime, everybody's craving an altered state of consciousness. They're getting the alcohol, they're getting the marijuana, they're watching TV, they're trying to do things, they're getting on social media, they're trying to do things where they can just distract from the day. And it definitely makes it challenging. Do you recommend the Momentous sleep stack or anything like that? Like, how do you feel about supplements in relation to, not necessarily for long-term use? Like, I don't want people getting addicted to melatonin, but can they be great tools to instill habits, to develop a routine where the wake up and sleep times do become a little bit more consistent and routine? Yep. And then over the course of time, you wean yourself off some of those sleep supplements.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I'm going to back up to what you said, which is a great kind of thing. And I have a concept in my book called the context dependent analysis. And it's basically just words for saying, assess each situation and what's the best thing that you can do in that moment instead of staying rigid to a certain program or thing. So like you said, if that's your only time to exercise, yes, the context dependent analysis is, I'd rather get the exercise in and then, you know, kind of work out how I can get the best sleep or whatever the case might be. And I think constantly people think in this all or nothing fashion instead of thinking of always something. And they're always like, oh, well, I couldn't get the exercise in, so I lost today. It's over. But it's like, no, you can go home and do 100 bodyweight squats, or you can go home and go for a walk or go for a runner or whatever the case is. And so I think that context dependent analysis with these situations is super important because those roadblocks are always going to be there. But to your question about supplements, I think we've kind of had this a theme of the conversation of like, it's all tools, tools that you can use. And I always err on the kind of Huberman framework of behavioral strategies first, nutritional strategy second, then you can get into the supplements, the drugs, the whatever the case is. So I would always recommend, hey, have you done this with your sleep environment? Hey, have you done this with consistent sleep times? Okay, let's move into nutrition. Hey, have you tried eating, you know, certain foods that contain the compounds that the supplements have? Hey, have you tried this nutritional intervention? And then, of course, I think a lot of people are at that supplement stage where they've tried a lot of these things and they still haven't gotten to the core of the issue. What I would recommend is natural third-party tested supplements. And obviously, for me, I got the great pleasure of working with Momentous and understanding the actual, you know, the way they go about their process, and they call it the Momentous standard. And it's trying to be head and shoulders above anything out there that is, you know, with testing, with analyzing their products, with understanding dosage, with understanding purity. And that to me is something that people don't see with supplements. They just see like, oh, get better sleep in 3 days or whatever the case might be. But if you don't see a NSF certification or a informed sport certification, you know that these companies aren't really going through the process to understand, is what's in that product matching what the dosage says? Is there a purity to that product and all of that, which can greatly, greatly, you know, vary in how it affects you. So I would say the Momentous Sleep Pack, I think it's just called Sleep Now, is an incredible product because it's all natural. It's three ingredients. Huberman talks about them all the time. L-theanine, apigenin, and magnesium threonate. And these three products are all naturally occurring substances. They're all in the correct dosage and they're non-habit forming. And I think that's a huge one because you don't want to, like you said, form a dependence or reliance on these supplements to where I don't have my supplements, I can't sleep tonight, oh my God, and it creates anxiety. They're non-habit forming, so you can take them when you need them. You can take them consistently. And a lot of people are actually deficient in magnesium, and a lot of people are deficient in some of these things. So it's actually a benefit beyond just the sleep. But the melatonin, like you mentioned, I'm a little hesitant to recommend. I would say that's like a break glass emergency type of thing in terms of jet lag or changing time zones, or really, really you need a good night of sleep and you had a tough couple of days, because melatonin is a hormone. We don't want to mess with the hormone system. We don't want to continue to give ourselves a hormone so that our body's like, oh, we got more of this hormone, let me downregulate how much we make. Then you're getting into a whole host of different issues. So I would say stick to the naturally occurring substances, stick to the behavioral nutritional first. And then of course, if you need to jump up to that next area, there are many, many things out there, but just make sure you're taking them from a reputable company.
I like the concept of non-habit forming. So many people in the world are probably pretty addicted to some sort of NyQuil when they're having a tough few nights and they just want to knock out completely. And yeah, the hormone system, that's another rabbit hole. Typically, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. It's kind of like an investment, man. If you're going to get a huge return really fast, probably a little bit dangerous. If it feels a little bit out of reach for the long term game for sure. Supplement market is crazy, man. Like back in the day, especially pre workouts, I would probably assume they were throwing cocaine in some of those things or the different batches. We've seen so many people like pop on drug tests and claim to not know, which is probably truthful from some and not truthful from others, but the NSF stamp I think is important. And the only two companies that I've seen with reputable sources are Momentus. I've seen it with Thorne, and I think BPN's got some stuff out there that's NSF approved, and that's keeping a wide array of athletes safe out there for the most part.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that stuff, man. I want to wrap it up with a conversation on lifestyle. I'm glad you used that term around mental health, emotion, and motivation in and around training.
Yeah.
Let's unpack that one a little bit for people.
Yeah. Lifestyle was the most fuzzy. And like I said, it's all semantics. And I think people can say, oh, well, that actually doesn't define this or that doesn't. It's all about helping people digest and understand these concepts. So I want people to focus less on the term. But for me, lifestyle is how you live. And that is, if I unpack that even more, there's so many things that are around the certain behaviors that you do. There's so many external factors, whether that be your mindset, whether that be stress, whether that be emotions, whether that be habits, goals, all of these things, all the intangibles. And so for me, I wanted to create a chapter that talked about all of these external factors that influence your mindset, your behaviors, your choices. And that one was a hard one to kind of construct and keep coherent because there's just so much information and everything is lifestyle. All of your behaviors, your choices, that's lifestyle. So for me, I wanted to focus on first stress. And I think stress is a concept that people misconceive. They think stress bad. And like stress isn't bad per se. Chronic stress is where you run into issues. Stress is great. Exercising is stress. Cold plunge is stress. Fasting is stress. Those are all great things. And there's this great concept of like hormesis and what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Everything in life is about, again, addressing something or putting yourself into a situation that is going to be tough, is going to make your body work, so that it can adapt and be better the next time it faces that thing, so that it can adapt and be better when it faces something similar. And so with stress, I start with that because I think that's a big concept and people need to understand that stress can actually be a good thing if you tell yourself in your mindset that, hey, stress is actually an enhancing behavior. And I think one of Huberman's guests, Aaliyah Crum, she does a great kind of synopsis of that. So go find her work if you want to hear that better. But when you get into mindset, we talked a little bit about growth mindset and how you can approach everything with a forward momentum, with a positivity that helps you address setbacks, that helps you move around obstacles, that helps you understand that this is just what life is. Life is that process, and how you kind of go about that process is integral into, you know, how you can, you know, move forward from it. And then you have things like emotions. Emotions was probably one of the most conflicting chapters or sections that I wrote because we don't really even know what emotions are. There's so much polarization in that field about what emotions are, how they're, you know, come about and how we can address them. But I think ultimately, emotions, motivation, and all of these things are broken down and explained in a way that's not, like I said, heavily scientific. It's more of, how can I use these things as tools to move forward? How can I build motivation? How can I address my emotions and face them and move past some of the negative ones and help channel them? And then I wrote a little bit about environment, which is probably my favorite. And we've talked a lot about that. And I think with environment, it is really powerful to build the right environment that make these habits easy to do, but it's also understanding the environment that you're in. So one of the concepts that I love is habits and traveling. So I always say, if a habit doesn't travel, then is it truly a habit? Because people like to think like, oh yeah, like I work out all the time, but then when they go travel, they don't work out. So it's like, is that truly a habit? Is that something you truly prioritize? And for me, I'll give you a quick story, which is one of my mentors, Josh Bonital. When I was at a previous company, Future, that does online and personal training through an app, I moved to San Francisco. I was in a new environment. Everything was changed. I wasn't really working out how I wanted to. I was trying to prove myself at a new company. I was trying to work up the corporate ranks, and my health was taking a back seat. And so I had to take a step back and understand what is going to make me be able to perform better is actually taking care of my health and actually putting that at the forefront so that everything else can, you know, follow suit. And so what we both started did, me and Josh, was we committed to working out every single day without fail. And so a lot of people think like, oh, like that's actually a bad thing. Your body needs to recover. We're not going and running, you know, marathons every day. We've been in this field for a long time, so we know how to, you know, change and adjust our workouts. But it eliminated this thought of like, it was no longer, oh, I have to work out each day. It was just a matter of like, this is just something that's going to happen no matter what.
It's like brushing your teeth. It became a non-negotiable versus when you were trying to climb the corporate rank, something else superseded your value system. And as a byproduct, you realized, hey, without my health, I actually can't climb the corporate wellness program anyway. And so that needed to switch orders. And even though the intensity and the aggressiveness of the workouts wasn't always a 10 to 10, the sheer habit of showing up, just as Simon Sinek always talks about, the consistency factor that we discussed early on in our conversation today. That's great that you were able to like just make it where like, hey, if I show up, whether it's 5 minutes or 50 minutes or it's heavy or light, I did the thing.
Yep. And it's a powerful concept and the momentum just keeps building. And like you said, it's like, if you can convince yourself to just show up, a lot of the times, I don't even want to put a percentage on it, but a lot of the time you actually do more than what you thought you were going to do. Mm-hmm. So if you say, oh, I'll just show up for 5 minutes, you end up going for 15 or you end up going for 20. And I think me and Josh starting this workout every day, it became a company-wide movement where everybody was trying to show up and work out more. It permeated through how we communicated as a company, how we, you know, built relationships and all of this stuff. And so that one simple habit of just showing up each and every day, fast forward now, it's been 3 or 4 years, and me and Josh both, we haven't missed a workout.
That's cool.
We post it on Instagram every day. It's something that, you know, a lot of people have joined in. I kind of tag it with Man on a Mission. And so again, it's just something now that I don't think about. I work out every day and it's something that brings me so much joy and it adds so much to my life that, again, I wouldn't even think twice.
You've
whether
made
I'm traveling,
it part of your
whether...
identity and it's a habit that can travel, which is great.
Exactly. So yeah, lifestyle in the end is kind of, you know, how you live, how you structure your life, your environment, your habits, your motivation. And I think it's all about how do you decrease friction so that the easy habits just flow and are, you know, not something that you have to think about. And that's what a habit is. It's an unconscious behavior that you can just do. And I think if we can decrease the friction on a lot of these things, we can make it so much smoother to, you know, deal with stress, to work out, to eat better, to all of that. And I think it sometimes people can look at it both ways of, I want to decrease the bad, but I also think there's this other of increasing the good. And I think sometimes people lean towards decrease the bad when I think increasing the good can actually be more powerful and can help you frame your mindset in a more positive manner.
That's beautifully said, man. I've got some rapid fire topics, phrases, or questions for you that I'd love you to respond in maybe a sentence or two and kind of summarize some cool things that I think will add some great value for people.
Peptides. There's been a lot of buzz about peptides and what they can do for the body, skin, muscles, and health. What exactly are they? And do they live up to the hype? Your body makes peptides. They are strings of amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Peptide therapy involves using prescription-based peptides to help treat and manage a variety of health conditions to maximize performance. Peptides consist of 2 to 50 amino acids and are made naturally in the body to act as important signaling molecules for many physiological and cellular functions. There are over 7,000 known functions of peptides in the body, and adequate levels in the body are imperative for performing at optimal levels. Discover a transformative journey to optimal well-being with Live Peptides. Live Peptides offer a natural and effective approach to health support. Embrace the difference. Choose Live. for a path to vitality that prioritizes quality, innovation, and your unique wellness goals. My personal favorite is BPC-157 with thymosin beta for optimizing gut health, tissue regeneration, and healing. Head over to livenatural.com and use code ALLSMITH for 20% off peptides. That's LIVVNATURAL.com with discount code ALLSMITH for 20% off peptides.
The first one is, dude, you're exploring the world now. You made the decision to leave the corporate world and you're adventuring. You're actually in New Zealand right now.
Yep.
How did you ultimately make that decision, and what's it been like so far?
I'll say this to keep it short, is the concept that I come back to is our happiness should never be deferred. Our happiness should never be deferred to a later time, to a later period, to after I do this. And I think you talked about it earlier. It's when I get this, I will do this. Or when this happens, then this happens. It's like, I'm healthy, I'm young, I don't have pets or kids yet. And why not? I have the financial flexibility to do it. And we've wanted to travel, we've wanted to see the world. And I think from a health and wellness perspective, I can better help people if I understand the vast amount of people in this world outside of just America, the culture, the way they eat, the things they do, how they take care of themselves. There's so much out there. And so for me, it's just taking in, experiencing, embracing, absorbing. But in one sentence, I would say happiness should never be deferred.
Nice, man. How have you managed remote work and difference in time zones and making sure that you carve out time for different workflow and the process of working on your new book and the things that do fill your bank account and allow you to do all the beautiful things that light your heart on fire for yourself and your wife?
Yeah, it's one, finding things that do light your fire, finding things that are hard to put down. I think for me, writing and, you know, disseminating health information is something that it burns so much in me that I have to actually stop myself from like trying to do it and trying to read and trying to record and get information out there. So find that thing that I say, like, you got to merge work and play until you can't tell the difference. And I think that's, some people don't have that, you know, privilege, and some people have to provide and find things, but if you can find that thing that merges work and play, you won't feel like you're working. And that's the real unlock. But I'll say one other thing, which is basically attach habits and behaviors to things that will happen every single day. So whether it's waking up, going to sleep, brushing your teeth, eating a meal, attach behaviors to those things because they're going to happen every day. And so if you can attach something to that, it's almost like habit stacking, what people call. But if you can kind of attach something to that, you know it's going to happen, and that'll trigger the thought in your head. Oh, before I go to sleep, I meditate. Or before I go to sleep, I read 5 pages of my book. And it's so much easier to build habits that way than to just inject it into a random part of your day and say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to work out on Monday. It's different from saying, I'm going to work out right before my lunch on Monday where I have this block of time.
The things that get scheduled are the things that get done.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Has there been a common thread that you think would add tremendous value to people's lives based on your travels around the world? One theme or maybe one habit that you've seen people all around the world do that you're like, wow, that thing's really a game changer.
Yeah, I actually have. And it's funny that this first thing came to mind. I think what I've seen in a lot of different countries is this sense of community and relationships around everything that they do. And I think in the US, a lot of people are distracted, and you see people walking down the street with their phones. You see people sitting at a meal eating with their phones. You see people talking with their phones. And it's like, there's a world out there, or there's a person on the other side. Like, the least you can do is look up, you know, see the world, experience the conversation that you're having, listen, pay that person the respect of all of that. So what I've seen a lot with a lot of different countries is just this community and relationship around how people are living. And that, I think, is a very, very underestimated aspect of health and wellness, is connection, relationships, and understanding that, you know, the more that you can it's not all about like taking, it's about giving back to the world that's providing so much for you. And so how can you be present? How can you embrace what's on the other side of you, whether that's nature, whether that's a person, whether that's a meal. And I think just being fully present in a lot of things that you're doing, and it can sound cliche. Yeah, I'm traveling and I'm trying to be fully present, but I think really opening your eyes and seeing the beauty of the world is something that a lot of people take for granted.
You can't fake community, man. And I think bonding and tribal connection is a really important piece that gets overlooked sometimes because we're so busy or we're trying to make money or, you know, typically when we are engaging, it's around drinking, but there's so many other ways to connect and experience together. And I that's actually the third or fourth time I've heard that exact depiction of a huge value that Americans have absorbed from traveling to other countries. So I really do think that people can add that into their day-to-day life. Most people don't know this about you, man. You were on a NFL commercial and you got to portray Jordan Love. How did that come to be? And what was that experience like?
Yeah. So, that was a fun one. When I was living in LA, I did a little bit of commercials and modeling on the side. And I was reached out to by an agent and she was just like, Kyle, I have a project or I have a, you know, a job for you. It's a quick turnaround. Let me know if you're up for it. You'd be impersonating an NFL player. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like who's the NFL player? And I immediately, because I get this, let me tell you, everywhere I go, somebody calls me Jalen Hurts everywhere. And I was certain that it was Jalen Hurts. And so when she said Jordan Love, I was like, oh, all right. Like, cool. Like that sounds great. Did I know that it was going to be a Ken from the Barbie movie impersonation? No. But I had to do an audition and it was fun to do the commercial. Everybody's like, God, like, did I just see you on, you know, Fox NFL News doing a Jordan? And I'm like, yeah, like that was me. But no, it was a fun project and it's always cool to, do these kind of different creative things when it comes to modeling or commercials and all that. But, yeah, it's a nice little side hustle, but so every once in a while you get a pretty big job.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Everything that's measured doesn't always count. And everything that counts isn't always measured. What comes to mind when I throw this collection of words together?
Oh, what comes to mind immediately is that a lot of the work that we do is in the shadows. And I think you got to get comfortable in the shadows. And you got to get comfortable with when nobody's watching, are you doing the right thing? When nobody's watching, are you taking care of your health? Because most of the time, nobody's watching. And a lot of the time, people don't care about you. You care about you a lot. And you think that everybody else is looking at you, thinking about you, caring about you. But ultimately, it's what we talked about earlier. It's that crowd of one. It's that crowd of Kyle. And you know, ultimately that's the crowd you're going to be with all the time. So how comfortable can you get when nobody's watching? How comfortable can you get when you're in the shadows? I think that is super, super important because it's not always going to be up on the scoreboard. It's not always going to be on social media. It's not always going to be a highlight reel, but you know, what you kind of can do in that time when nobody's watching is actually going to define your health, define who you are.
What comes to mind for me there is Draymond Green. Being an energy creator, setting great screens, getting great handoffs, being disruptive, and doing things that don't necessarily show up on a stat sheet. Yep. But when you look at the productivity of both Steph and Clay, along with Andrew Wiggins and a few others in the past, their productivity is 10x when Draymond's on the floor with them. Yep. And you know, there's a lot of that doesn't always float to the surface and get the claps or the highlight reel. But it is something that I think is a really cool intangible of what you're doing, Kyle. And my last question to wrap it up today, man, what's the greatest advice that you've ever received?
Oh man, that's a tough one. Greatest advice I've ever received. I would say it comes back to that concept of, this wasn't really advice. I kind of received it from multiple people, but this concept of like the audience comes last and just being as unique and embracing your true personal self in everything that you do, whether it's the work that you create, the route that you take with your health and wellness. I think the more that we can be uniquely ourselves, the better the outcome will be in any form of work, in any form of project, in any form of thing that you pursue. And so I had a long period of time where I was always trying to emulate someone else, or I was always trying to build a concept based on somebody else's concept. But I think when I can take a step back and understand what works for me, what has my experience taught me, what have I learned from other people, and kind of culminate that into my own unique take or my own unique approach, I think that is where the best comes out, because ultimately you're going to be the best at being you, because you're the only one that can be you. So I think the saying is, don't be the best at what you do, be the only. And so that's kind of what I'm going for, is not to be the best, but to be the only Kyle Gonzalez.
I love that, man. There you hear it, guys. Creating a healthier tomorrow today with author of The Vitality System, Kyle Gonzalez. Thanks for joining me today, man. That was dope.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, man. I'm hot. I'm sweaty. I'm ready to get after it. You got me ready to run through a brick wall. So I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate the conversation. And I look forward to continuing to connect and continuing to give good information out to the world, because that's what it's all about, man.
Yeah, I appreciate you so much. Where can people find you?
Yeah, people can find me on all the major social medias at Kyle Gonzalez 3 or at The Vitality System. And like you mentioned there, you can find my book, The Vitality System, podcast, and my newsletter. But yeah, if you're interested in seeing more of the travels or hearing more health and wellness information, check those out. And yeah, other than that, I'm just going to get back to living and traveling and experience this beautiful world.
LIVIN, my man. For those of you listening, if you enjoyed my conversation with Kyle Gonzalez today on the Allsmith Project, please rate, review, subscribe, and share with your friends. And remember, greatness is forged, not found. Till next time, guys.